Thanks for listening to another episode of Project Zion. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. Project Zion is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Brittany Mangelson, and tonight we have on Nancy Ross, who is about to be confirmed in the Southern Utah Community of Christ congregation. So welcome, Nancy.
Thank you, Brittany. Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited about this conversation. Just to give a little bit of background, Nancy has a podcast called Faith Transitions, and she has interviewed several of the Project Zion hosts on that podcast. And So she's also given her own faith narrative on her podcast. And so we're going to list or link that down below. And so if you want to get like a full comprehensive view of where she's been on her faith journey, then I would encourage you to go listen to that first. But we are going to start with more recent years, and she was heavily involved with the Ordained Women organization with the LDS Church. So Nancy, I just want to hear you talk about it. So what can you tell us about your involvement with Ordained Women?
Sure. Okay. So before Ordained Women came around in March of 2013, I should just say, and I think I've mentioned this before, and I've talked with other, I think I may even have like an Exponent blog post about this, but a couple of years before, I think it was in 2011, 2012, I was actually reading a series of books. I'm an art historian. I teach art history at my university. And I was reading a bunch of books on early Christian art. And in my studies, I had ended up like interlibrary loaning a book by an author named Gary Macy on, and the title is something like The Hidden History of Women's Ordination. I was like, whatever that is about, I'm just going to like read it and make fun of it. Cause surely that is just like full of nonsense. Right. And so, and that was, you know, like, whatever, you know, I'll just see what scholars are saying about this, but I bet the evidence is really thin. So I read that book, and it was like late one night, and my husband was like asleep next to me, and I was just, you know, up late reading. And the evidence was real. The historical evidence for the ordination of women in the early Christian church, what to my surprise was like decent. Like it was good. It was good, solid evidence. And I just remember like immediately like stopping and praying and be like, you know, like, dear Heavenly Father, is this like for real? And the overwhelming response I got was like, yeah. And it's like late at night, and it's like my world has just been destroyed. And it's like, well, what am I supposed to do about that? That was like my follow-up question. Like, what am I supposed to do about that? And God, and I felt like the response I got from God was like, you need to wait. And it's like, okay. Like my view of things, my view of like religion and women in the church has just been destroyed. And you're like, I need you to hold on for a little bit. And I didn't even know what to do that. And I was like, am I going to wait for like 40 years? You know, am I going to have this experience and then like wait for 40 years? And then maybe the LDS church will start moving towards ordination. I don't even know. But from that moment on, you know, I just had this really definitive experience of having a testimony that women had been ordained, and because they had been ordained in the past, they could be ordained in the present and in the future. And so, you know, like 6 months later, so I think that, and I just kept this to myself because I knew this was super scandalous. Even within the Mormon feminist community, we weren't having that conversation. It was still kind of taboo. And then like 6 months later, you know, I mentioned to my husband, oh yeah, by the way, I believe in the ordination of women. And I think just because he realized how disturbing that was, not how like not Mormon that was, you know, not very acceptable. It was kind of upsetting. And I think he kind of got over that. So what happened though, but I was still like, I felt like God had told me like, you need to wait. And I'm like, wait for what? And there's like no further guidance there. And so what happened was I came home from church. It must have been like Sunday, March 17th was the release date of the Ordained Women website. And I saw somebody post it in one of probably an FMH or in Feminist Mormon Housewives Facebook group. And I was like, what's this? And at first I thought this must be a hoax. This is like somebody's idea of a bad joke. Cause it just looked so, the website looked so churchy. Like it looked like a lot of like very righteous Mormon women. There were just like photographs of very ordinary looking Mormon women. And so I sent an email to like the contact address, like, is this for real? And it was probably like Kate Kelly or Lori Winderstromberg who wrote back being like, yeah, you know, we're looking for profiles. And I sent my profile in that day.
Wow.
Cause I felt that sense of like now, like that's like the word when I saw it and I realized that it was real and not a hoax. I realized that like, this is the call. Like God had said, wait, and then the time was now. So I sent in my profile that day. I had not been involved with any of the earlier conversations about Ordained Women. I didn't know that that was going on, but the day it was launched, I submitted my profile. Eventually there was a Facebook group created, and for Ordained Women supporters, and I was on that. And then after a few months, I think it was probably, you know, Cater others, started asking for volunteers and I volunteered. And then I think it was that September of 2013, Kate Kelly asked me to be the, social media person, for Ordained Women. And that would come with a position on the board of the newly formed board for Ordained Women. And I did that very intensely for a year before I stepped down. So that's a little bit of my background with Ordained Women.
Yeah. So can you talk about, because you said that Ordained Women, the website, I mean, it looked very churchy, like a bunch of, yeah, you know, faithful mm-hmm. church women. Mm-hmm. And from my understanding, and I know that there's all sorts of people that would disagree, but I mean, mm-hmm. I don't want to like hashtag haters them, but kind of, you know, like people that.
Yeah, there are those who disagreed with Ordained Women. Yep. Those
definitely. But also that, I mean, kind of called you guys like wolves in sheep's clothing that, you know, totally. Definitely yeah. thought that you were all borderline apostates or even out the door already. But do you want to, I guess what I'm asking is, do you want to speak to the faithfulness and the sincerity of the women who were involved, especially at the beginning?
Yeah, no. I guess I can kind of best speak to my own experience, but I would mm-hmm. say that, you know, there were a few people who were involved who were not active or were maybe were in the process of, or were less active or kind of unsure, but there were a number of us who were very active. If we want to score Mormon points, in 2010, 2011, and 2012, so the 3 years prior to Ordained Women, I had had, a New Year's resolution to read the whole Mormon canon, so all Mormon scripture, in a year.
Oh wow!
And I did that three times.
Wow.
Right. So, you know, and I think that I was probably teaching like Sunbeams or Relief Society Pianist, or then I was, I think in 2013, I was called like as a Relief Society teacher. So I was a very active, very temple recommend holding, very devout person with some feminist leanings, but very much acting from a place of faith, because I came to believe, have this very strong belief in that women should be ordained, very much that came, you know, as an act of faith, you know, through prayer and spiritual confirmation. Those things were very important to me. My relationship with God had been very important to me. And I was very committed. There was a very committed Mormon, like almost maybe a little bit too much, as evidenced by the scripture reading thing. But like, but yes. So, and I can't speak to the details of like other people's personal spiritual lives, but most of the women that I was involved with on the board and in the supporters group, you know, they were very, there were a lot of active people at that time. in ordained women in 2013.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense because, I mean, I've always thought about it. If you're an 11-year-old Mormon boy, it's what they would call a righteous desire to want ordination, to take that next step, to become a deacon. And it's seen as this big milestone, this big spiritual, you know, like climbing up this spiritual mountain. And it's celebrated. But yet the moment a woman even thinks about it, you know, it's just complete heresy. And how dare you? And you're an apostate and Satan has your heart. And it's just, I've never understood that. And I don't know if I ever will.
Crazy. No, I know. When I had that kind of spiritual confirmation, it's like when God was like, yeah, women have been ordained and they can be ordained. Part of me just felt like it was such a powerful moment. But then like the next thought, like once this kind of little episode was done, was like, crap, like now I'm a bad Mormon. And that really, more than many other things, brought into tension this sense of like, I just had this powerful spiritual experience with God, and like the church was over here doing something else.
Yeah, drastically different things.
Right. And I mean, I didn't even so much as tell my husband until like like 6 months later, maybe. Just because I knew what an explosive, just to say that was just explosive. And my husband is very progressive, right? But even that's something that bad Mormon feminists wanted. And I wanted to be a Mormon feminist, and I was one, but I still, you know, saw myself as being, you know, a very Orthodox Mormon. And so I didn't really want to give that up either.
Yeah, it's a really tricky space to be in. And I remember, I mean, when I was starting to realize these things too, it's like, okay, how do you be a Mormon and still be in this space of equality and of lobbying for equality or whatever, however you want to label
right.
it. But yeah, it's a really, really tricky space because, again, like even if you just think it out loud, I mean, just whisper it, it's, I mean, one of the worst things you could say. So.
Right. So when I have this confirmation, it's like, crap, you know what? I bet things are going to happen as a result of the spiritual experience. Like, it's probably not going to be great. It's probably not going to work out real well. And that largely was true.
Yeah.
You know, but it was, you know, it just ended up being a very important moment for me so that when ordained women appeared on the scene, I knew that that's what I had to do. Like, I knew that I needed to be a part of that. And that was so exciting. That was so exciting in those early days. It was like faithful Mormon women, you know, respectfully asking for the priesthood. And I know that people disagree with that, maybe ordained women were respectful or whatever, but that's certainly how we saw ourselves and what we strive for, in the organization. And, so then there were a number of actions. I was, involved, from a distance with the first priesthood action, October 2013, but the April 2014 action, I was very much there and very involved with the planning of that, you know, and that just further was just a huge moment of change. You know, I am a people pleaser by personality, and I don't really like confrontation. And, I was really terrified to actually, I was very excited for the event, in April, 2014, when we had about 500 people on Temple Square asking for admission into the priesthood session. And, it was very exciting, and there was a lot of gearing up for it, but, and I knew that I would be, I was just, when it actually came down to walking from City Creek Park to the tabernacle, I was just terrified. Like, I was just terrified with my body. I was doing something that I saw as absolutely faithful, but I knew was confrontational, and culturally challenging, and that, you know, that wouldn't necessarily be received really well. But I felt like it was something that I really needed to do for so many reasons. And when I went through that experience, I was not exact. I was just a few people in, maybe 8 people in from the front of the line. And I wasn't really prepared to be rejected from the meeting. I thought that for sure, after all the bad press of the previous action, that they would just let us in because that would just be easy. And, you know, then it wouldn't really be a big story. But that's not what happened. And then I had to like ask for admittance into the building, and then I had to be rejected. And with all these people and like cameras and a lot of pressure. And that was, in many ways, you know, I was, you know, trying to be respectful and trying to explain that I'd come a long way and I would really like to attend the meeting. It was such a difficult confrontational thing for people pleasing Nancy to do. And in that experience, I just was kind of like dazed for a little while after that experience. Then we ended up collecting in another space, but it was like confronting so much fear that I didn't even realize that I had, about fear of authority, fear of doing the wrong, fear of people seeing me as doing the wrong thing. That experience of like facing that fear and doing what I thought was right anyway, it just changed me, like, in a very profound way, because I realized that I didn't need to be bound by fear of hierarchy and authority that maybe didn't want the best thing for me. It was just a very powerful experience, and facing that fear just led to shedding fear and letting go of fear, and further letting go of being seen as maybe the wrong kind of Mormon.
Wow. I really appreciate hearing that. I sat on my computer that night and just watched it unfold on Facebook, and it was traumatizing. I mean, there was a real sense of violence, and I was safe behind a computer screen, but I just remember watching the live updates from FMH, and people were posting pictures, and it was very violent. I mean, that's the only word that I can use to describe it. So I mean, just thank you to all of you that attended that action. I think it changed a lot of us, even those who weren't there.
And as someone who was in charge of social media, you know, and very much involved in the planning, and then I think we had kind of an afterwards survey of the event. No, we did have an afterwards survey of the event of people's experiences. You know, that really, it was powerful. It was scary. It was kind of traumatic. And I think we were all very aware. And in each of our pockets, we carried the names of others who were not able to, or were kind of a little too terrified to be there. And, you know, I know that we felt the weight of a lot of people both looking at it, watching from afar and watching from afar and cheering us on and watching from afar just to see what would happen. You know, it was big, and it felt, you know, it felt big at the time, and not necessarily just like super happy, yay, but it felt for me personally just terrifying. I remember taking those first steps out of City Creek Park, and I was at the front of the line, so my photograph ended up in like the Tribune a bunch of times, and apparently there was some footage that appeared on the news that night, and you know, that was interesting to navigate afterwards. But that, like, it was just terrifying. It was just terrifying. But in facing that fear, like, that, I didn't even realize I carried around that fear. But beginning to both see that I was carrying it around and begin to let it go. I remember driving home. I'd spent the night at Lori's, and left early the next morning. I was still feeling a little disoriented and trying to process what had happened, but drove home and then just started to feel like the lifting of weights throughout that next week as I tried to understand what I had experienced and how I felt about it. But, you know, stuff like that, you do that. I was so invested in that event. You know, I was never going to be quite the same person afterwards. You know, like it was just a big moment of growth for me.
Yeah. So where did you go from there? I mean, you still continue to be involved with Ordaining Women for a little while after that. Is that correct?
No, very, very much so. I stepped down from the board in September of 2014. Okay. My responsibilities with Ordaining Women in social media, I did a lot of editing and posting of profiles and just managing a lot of behind the scenes elements. I checked the email, including the hate mail that, you know, Ordaining Women got, and just dealt with a lot of different things. And it really, I had a full-time job as a an assistant professor, but it felt like another full-time job on top of that. And I had young children, and after a year, it was time to step down and let someone else take on that particular role. But that moment in April, you know, that's, you know, a lot of things changed.
Yeah. So by the time you stepped down, did you, I guess, still have hope? Or, I mean, through all of this, did you have hope that the church would respond, you know, the LDS church would respond positively, or maybe even at all, because they still haven't responded?
Right. We never quite got a decent answer anywhere. Yeah. So what happened? So of course a lot of, maybe probably, I don't know who exactly listens to this podcast, but you know, Mormons and Mormon feminists will know that. So if this event happens in April, then it's in June that we get news that Kate Kelly has had, that she's been summoned to a church court. And then so we host a rally, I think it was June 23rd, which was my youngest daughter's birthday, very strangely. And we held a rally in Salt Lake to, outside of the church office building, in support of Kate. And then found out the next day during an Ordained Women board meeting that, she had been excommunicated. And I just really believed all through that whole episode that God was really going to intervene and stop this nonsense, that things had changed, that the church was not the same as it had been exactly in September of 1993, when excommunicated six Mormon feminists. And up until the moment that Kate got the email, I was just like so certain and so full of Mormon certainty that that somebody was going to like prevent this from happening. You know, I had helped collect about 1,200 letters in support of Kate that were, you know, used kind of as evidence or whatever. I mean, they were probably never looked at, but in her trial. But we had done a lot to try and a lot of attempts at back channeling interventions, and none of that had been successful, but I was sure that somewhere someone was going to like shut that nonsense down. And I was so sure of this, like up to the moment that she got the email that, from her bishop that she had been excommunicated. And so that really, I was in shock. Like, that was in the middle of an Ordained Women board meeting, and we were all waiting for this news. And so there was a lot of tension, and like Deborah Jensen and Heather Olsen-Burfield were just like head and cracking like jokes all day long, just to try and like lighten the mood, and like dark jokes about excommunication and things. And then within like seconds, the whole room is in tears. I don't think I was in tears. I was just in shock. It's like, no, wait, God. I was pretty sure that God wasn't going to let this happen. So like, what are we doing here? Like, what's going on? And I was very, very distraught. And I think some of the older women in Ordained Women really understood what was going to happen and how this was going to play out. But I was very optimistic and very hopeful that the church that I knew and loved was going to do the right thing. And the right thing was not excommunicating Kate Kelly.
Yeah.
And
it was terrible.
Yeah. Right? Like, it was so bad. It was so bad.
Yeah, and I kept saying, there's no way they will excommunicate her. There's too much at stake. There's too much press. There's no way. And then because it happened.
I know. I know. And the church had been working so hard on good press, you know, through the Mormon moment. And, you know, and through like the Mitt Romney campaign and through the Book of Mormon musical and through lots of different kinds of challenges had worked to, you know, with the I'm a Mormon campaign to try and build, you know, Mormons are normal. Mormons are just like you. They're good people. And it really felt like it just didn't care enough about that. I was willing to sacrifice all that to prove some kind of point, some kind of political point or political positioning sort of point. And that was deeply upsetting, isn't even the right word. And so my hope after that, I felt like my hope for change was really wounded. And I really wasn't sure about the direction of the church, but I was still attending. Like I still, you know, I went back and taught Relief Society the next Sunday. And, you know, and I'm standing in front of like 30 women, you know, and knowing that like, okay, they're all hating me right now, or they're all having, you know, very unkind thoughts or, you know, thinking I'm apostate or whatever. But like, you know, I'm the Relief Society teacher and I'm just going to do this anyway. So so kind of like trying to be like defiantly righteous, if that's even a position that one can take. And that became increasingly difficult. And eventually later that year, I was released from that calling. And certain people got more and more critical of my lessons and accused me of not doing enough to read from the manual. There just ended up being a lot of complaints and a lot of discussion and like in the ward and in the community about me that I wasn't really a part of and no one was talking to me, but it all just like when everything just really turned south, it kind of turned south. And so that happened and I still didn't know. I was like, you know, I hope that this gets better, you know, like I had believed before, I had all this hope before, and maybe I can have this hope again. But my hope wasn't actually broken. Like, it was really damaged by the excommunication of Kate Kelly, but it wasn't broken. That would come later. And a few months later, you know, everything has just been really intense. I've been working at Ordained Women like it's a full-time job while having a full-time job and children. And then it all just kind of became too much. And so I stepped down from the board in September of 2014. But it was, I mean, I learned so much. I learned about organization. I learned about activism. I learned about social media. I learned about faith. I learned about the church in more ways than I had hoped to learn about the church. But I still wasn't quite broken on the idea of hope. And in fact, around in the later months of 2014 and the beginning of 2015, I became part of a group of Mormon and former Mormon scholars who wanted to do some survey work with Mormons to try to better understand their views on gender. And so our views on gender, their views, I don't even know how to deal with my own identity in Mormonism anymore. But to deal with Mormons' views on gender, it's kind of a confusing thing. So we did some surveys, and we actually ended up conducting what was the biggest survey of Mormons ever. We had more than 50,000 respondents, and that was super awesome. And in the process of writing a book chapter for the Voices of Equality book, on that particular survey data, you know, the tremendous and amazing finding from some of the open-ended responses we asked people were that people actually had really mixed, ordinary Mormons had really mixed views on gender. And they thought that some things maybe did come from God, some kind of different treatment of men and women did come from God, and that maybe other kinds of treatment, different treatment of men and women was cultural, and that sometimes different treatment of men and women was beneficial, but other times it really wasn't. And these, a lot of these responses that we got were just kind of really mixed. And I really hadn't expected that. Because I expected that, you know, Mormons would have kind of a more monolithic view on gender, and they'd be like, yeah, different treatment of men and women is good. And it, you know, it more or less all comes from God. And that's just kind of how the way things are. And so that's not really the response that we got. And as I was doing this research and saw that, you know what, it was like 45% of the respondents that we had these very mixed views on gender. And as I was looking at that, I thought, you know what? you know, this, there's a lot of potential for change here. Like if the body of the church can really begin to see gender in more nuanced ways and then express that, then there's hope that the church will someday in its policies and procedures come to reflect that as well. And so, people often see faith and scholarship as being very separate things. I don't necessarily. And so doing that scholarly work really helped restore my faith in Mormons and in the church. And so I could be hopeful once again. So like I could be like, okay, I actually have hope for change after doing that academic work and that research.
I don't think I realized that your survey had that many Mormons responded.
It did.
That's incredible.
It was a really funny thing because we had started to share it in social media. And one of the theories behind the kind of survey where you just start sharing it in social media is that enough people share it, then the demographics of the survey will actually start to reflect the actual demographics of the group you're hoping to target. Mm-hmm. So if it's shared enough times. And so I'm sharing it and I'm sharing it in my progressive Mormon spaces online and other people are kind of taking it and sharing it and that's good. But then I sent it to Mormon Women's Stand, which is a very conservative Mormon women's organization online. And they were totally outraged and they had like 30,000 followers on their Facebook page. And so they posted it like, you have to take this as a statement because these progressive academics are totally trying to misrepresent Mormons. And so we need good Mormon women, faithful Mormon women to take this and like show them what's right, which is exactly what we wanted them to do.
Yeah,
right. Like that's
yeah.
Like, right. But, and then there were several other more conservative blogs that kind of blogged along that same lines. Like, you know, like you, like it's your religious duty to take this survey and prove them wrong. What, you know, like, you know, and so we got great data. And so it was shared just an absurd number of times. And that was my idea to share it with like Mormon Women's Stand and several other conservative outlets. So I really take a lot of credit for the very high number of responses that we received. Not sole credit, certainly not, but
well, that's genius. But, you know,
yeah. Like social media genius for whatever that is. But doing that research work, that was like, okay, you know, I can have faith. I can have faith and I can have hope that there's going to be change. I can see that people are maybe in that space where they could be ready for change and accept change, but they're not necessarily going to ask for it. And so it's like, okay, you know, like I can work with that. You know, that's some things that have happened that were really upsetting, but I can move forward with in the belief and in the hope that things can and will change if very slowly. And so that's kind of how 2015 went until November 5th.
Mm,
yeah. And then my hope really did break. Like, and it broke irreparably. That hope for positive change in the church. And when I say November 5th, of course, I'm referring to the kind of leak to John DeLynn online that the church had changed its policies with regard to LGBT people, that LGBT people who married same-sex partners would need to be called in on charges of apostasy and experience church courts and probably be excommunicated as a result. And also that their children would be ineligible for all church ordinances, they'd be ineligible for including baptism. And that was just like, what just happened? You know, that was like being hit by an unexpected train. And it just like crushed my hope and broke it in a way that like, I know I'm never going to be able to put that back together. Like that's, I had already done a lot of work to try and repair hope and repair faith and find a way forward. And even though I'd been involved with ordained women since 2013, you know, but other gender issues had been just eating at me for a long time, in much smaller ways. But that combined with, you know, difficulty in my ward, like, and I was, you know, still fully attending and had just recently renewed my temple recommend, when the exclusion policy, is kind of how we refer to it, was leaked, that I just knew I was just going to have to find a way out. And I had never really contemplated doing that before. I'd always been very committed and felt very called to stay within Mormonism, to try and make it work, even though, especially after the excommunication of Kate Kelly, a lot of Mormon feminists stopped participating in the LDS Church. And I have, survey data that shows that both from before and after. I already experienced other big challenges and ongoing challenges in my ward, in my congregation. And after the exclusion policy, it was kind of 2 months of homophobia. I just didn't feel that I could, that when people said things about LGBT people, that I could push back, or that I had like either the strength or the credibility, or that it would only end up me being excommunicated very quickly. Like, it was just kind of a nightmare, and it caused me tremendous anxiety, it's where like you kind of come home from church and you're like, wow, that was really rough. And week after week after week, I knew that I couldn't. And earlier, fairly soon after this all happened, And I knew my hope had broken. And if my hope had remained, I probably might have been able to remain, maybe. But I knew that I needed to leave. And I knew in that same moment that I needed something else. Because, I like God and community. And I knew that I wasn't done with religion, even if I might be done with Mormonism. And so I knew I needed to reach out. So I reached out about, I knew that Lindsay Hansom Park had at one point had a house church going. So I messaged her, and she was like, well, you need to contact like Robin Linkhart from Community of Christ. And I had met Robin at Feminist Mormon and Girls Camp the year before, and had liked her, and she had really impressed me at Girls Camp. She and Katie Langston had sung For Everyone Born. And I'd never heard that before. And that song has just a real vision of Christianity as an inclusive, community. And, the hymns that I had sung as a Mormon on Sunday were not really inclusive. It was a lot of us versus them, and the good people and the bad people, and that kind of talk, but not very inclusive talk. And so I contacted Robin, and it turns out that at that same time that some other people from St. George had contacted Robin Linkhart about starting, Community of Christ Options in St. George. And like within the week, or like the next week, she was like down here and meeting with people. And I'm still like at the beginning of being super broken. So I'm like, I don't even know what I'm doing, but this seems like maybe it could be a good thing. There really aren't a lot of other progressive communities and, religious communities in St. George. I also felt like if I was going to go to a different church, that it'd be really great if the church could, understand or, not make fun of my Mormon upbringing and life and faith life that I had lived. And I like that, that the LDS Church and the Community of Christ had some shared history, and the Book of Mormon had been such an important part of my development of faith. And that even though maybe I no longer believed in the Book of Mormon as a literal historical document, that I still needed to kind of honor that part of my faith journey, and that would be okay in Community of Christ. And so even though I didn't know much about it, like I went through, contacted Robin, we met, and then we met kind of as a group of people who might be interested here in St. George. And then a year ago, just a couple of days ago, we've just celebrated our first anniversary. Seth Bryant, became our pastor, and we held our first, Southern Utah Community of Christ, congregation worship service. And I I'd been assigned to like play the hymns for the first, I show up at this kind of borrowed church space. We meet at a Presbyterian church in St. George, and just feeling in the space of tremendous grief, like I'm here because my church rejected me, which is never a good feeling. And, playing hymns and a small room with people I didn't know, being led by a pastor, like a, like, you know, like, who is Seth? You know, I don't know. I mean, he's a great guy. And so this is really funny now, but like, yeah. But you know, just, and, but, you know, like in this moment being, I just remember like sitting there during the service, kind of between hymns where I was kind of playing the piano, being like, what am I even doing here? Like what, you know, like, can I really not make it work with my ward? Do I really have to leave? Like, I'm here by myself. My family isn't with me. You know, like Mormonism is all about families and you have to do everything together with your family. And like, here I am on my own. You know, this doesn't bode well, you know, but it still felt like I should stick with it. And I did. And I continued to play the hymns and to spend a lot of time practicing them. And that was interesting because there was a lot of music that I wasn't familiar with. So it's always weird to have to play hymns that you've never sung or heard before. And so being like, and then with people singing them who had never heard them. But so there was a lot of like awkward singing, you know, in those first weeks. And it was about the eighth week that we had met together. And suddenly my friend Melody, who's in our congregation, she has a really lovely singing voice. I think it was like on that day that she just decided she was going to sing loud. Like she was ready to just like embrace what we had and just kind of, sing. And it's funny because over that time we would have our services and then like, chat a lot afterwards. And most of the people really, just about everybody who was attending in those very early days, they were also other kind of, if you will, refugees from Mormonism. And, you know, we would spend time kind of chatting and sharing afterwards. And that felt really comforting. And very quickly, I realized that there were parts of the service that maybe were unfamiliar to me, things like the prayer for peace or just, you know, a different order of service or a different way of speaking that was unfamiliar, but it very quickly started to feel good. I remember in those early days, Seth gave a sermon on peace, which was really lovely. As someone who had, who was a veteran of Afghanistan, I think, who had been a chaplain in the, gosh, I'm going to butcher this. I want to say Air Force. Maybe it's the Army. I could be wrong.
I think it was Marines.
Marines. Okay. So, but he'd been right. He'd been a chaplain. He'd been a chaplain in like Afghanistan as a veteran. And here he was like standing in front of us talking about peace. And I realized, as he was talking about peace, that I had actually never heard anyone give a talk in church about peace, like ever. And I was like, huh, that's really interesting. And then, so I started thinking, and every time what I started to realize was that in every service, there would be hymns or something in a hymn. The Community of Christ hymn book, you know, has a lot of very progressively worded hymns. And that was surprising to me and just a real comfort and relief, to be kind of playing the music. And even though these hymns were unfamiliar, I started to kind of quickly realize that I liked them and I liked the messages that they had, even if maybe the music was new and unfamiliar and, you know, maybe it was hard to sing new hymns with a tiny new congregation and that sort of things, that I realized that I really liked the music. And I realized that I always had something to think about when I left the service, whether, you know, it was often something from the prayer for peace or the sermon, that there was always some new idea, which was different from what the kinds of things I had heard in church before. There were a lot more social justice minded things. It wasn't about like judgment and afterlife, which I feel like felt like so much of Mormon discourse and talks and things spoke to, but rather, you know, the talks in Community of Christ that I heard in those early days really spoke to different kinds of like shared community values. And that was just really refreshing. And it helped me to begin to see that faith didn't just, it wasn't like, certainty is faith or faith is only, you know, this one set of ideas or believing in a particular way, but faith could be something like shared values and a belief in God, and that it was okay not to have to pin down all the details. And that was just very comforting. And at the same time, During those first few months, I was still attending sacrament meeting with my family in my ward. And then in March of this year, we stopped. The children and I stopped attending the ward. My husband was leading the music in the sacrament meeting, the main meeting. And so he continued. But then we moved away from our ward in May. And that was a relief to move away because I live in Southern Utah and, you know, they're very close-knit Mormon communities. And in our little rural community that we had lived in, you know, most of our neighbors were Mormon and most of our neighbors are part of the ward. And so not only when Kate Kelly was excommunicated and when I was very involved with ordaining women and other people knew, even though it wasn't something I talked about on a Sunday, you know, things just got more and more awkward and more difficult socially. And it was just a huge relief when we moved away from that community, which was also sad because I had had friends and my participation in like ordaining women, made them feel very uncomfortable. And, you know, and I had a good friend once tell me that she felt like I was dangerous. And that was just a very, like, that's to be the kind of person who is going to like, okay, I'm going to have like a New Year's resolution to like read the whole Mormon canon in the year and then do that again several times, to then go from like that, from like the very orthodox practice to being told by other fairly devout and orthodox practicing people that, that I was dangerous was very, very hard. You know, that felt like a lot of rejection.
For sure.
from people who I had cared about and served with and served, you know, at various times, and loved, you know, that felt like, a lot of rejection. And so, but then we moved, and which is a relief. It also felt like I had run from a difficult situation, and that kind of felt crappy. But then getting that distance was from the community was helpful. And slowly, the first couple of months after the exclusion policy, I just felt like someone had died and I was mourning like the death of a close relative. But by the time June came around and then this kind of progressed through the summer, a lot of that, I kind of got through to the end of some of that grief. And then it was probably at the end of the summer, the beginning of fall and the new academic year, I felt like maybe I was ready to think about confirmation. We'd had a couple of friends in my congregation be confirmed. I think it was in March. And that was super exciting. And part of me had wanted to like jump right in and be confirmed with them. And then I realized that wasn't a good idea. And I wasn't ready. And what I really would wanted was to go from like my very high demands Mormon life to embracing community of Christ in a similar way without actually trying to work through the issues, just going from one trying to belong to another trying to belong without actually just letting things happen more gradually and more naturally. And the other people who were confirmed had been out of Mormonism for much longer than I had. They didn't measure that in months, but in years. And so they were ready to take that step. And I knew that I kind of, when I saw that was a wonderful experience, seeing them be confirmed, it was very affirming. I felt good about our community. It was like, yay, we had survived for a couple of months. That was really nice. But I knew that I probably would be confirmed, but that I had some like faith work to do. And then it was kind of about that same time that it was kind of announced that Seth wasn't going to be our pastor anymore. And that that we had another pastor who was taking over, and I just felt like I was barely starting to get to know Seth and I liked him and liked what he had to say, during our Sunday meetings. He had been part of me beginning to think about faith and to think about Christianity and to think about worship in some new ways. And that had kind of if you can imagine thinking about things really narrowly and then like prying that open, you know, prying that open and creating more space. And I felt like Seth had helped me create more space to think about faith differently. And when Emily, our new pastor, who had, you know, she just graduated with her master's in divinity this last summer. Like, she was just in the process of finishing up when she became our pastor, and she's about 10 years younger than I am. And it was like, oh, I was just making this progress, and now we have this very new pastor. Okay. And then we all fell in love with Emily, like, immediately, because she's very enthusiastic, and she made a tremendous effort to try and understand the Mormon experience. She did a lot of homework, talking to people, listening to stories, listening to podcasts, reading blog posts, to, you know, becoming part of communities that had not been within her experience, because she had been Community of Christ all of her life. And so that was really different. Like, what she had to say was similar in some ways to Seth's experience, but Seth had been Mormon before, and so he'd been through that transition, and so he had had all the sensitivity. And Emily picked that up very quickly, picked a lot of that sensitivity and with tremendous compassion. And with Emily had just ended up suggesting some different things that I might read. I had an idea, like, I realized at this kind of in the summer stage that, like, okay, I wasn't really concerned with, like, an afterlife anymore. And Mormonism is so focused on, like, building up good brownie points for a good afterlife experience that you can have with all of your family. And I kind of let go of that idea. And I wasn't a biblical literalist, but I just, like, let all that go in a very strong way. And just began more actively kind of deconstructing, like, what did I believe, what was still important to me. I remember I was speaking on Easter Sunday, and as I stood up to, like, speak, I realized I just wasn't sure that I actually believed in the resurrection. It's like, crap. Like, I used to really like that, you know, and now I don't even know anymore. And then being comfortable, learning to kind of sit in the uncomfortable place of not knowing exactly what I believed in, and that being okay, right? Because that's the framework that I come from, or that I had taken with me from Mormonism, was like, you know, certainty is the goal, and, you know, you need certainty, and with faith you're always working towards certainty, and because certainty is kind of the prize of faith. And I had always known, and for a long time I had realized that that was a bad concept, but hadn't really replaced it with anything better. And with a lot of things at that time, starting to realize, you know, I don't have a solid answer here. And maybe I'm not really looking for a solid answer about history or the divinity of Jesus, but maybe that was just okay. Like, maybe I could look for an answer, and maybe there'd be a time when I would feel like I would need to look for, like, a solid answer, but just living in that place where it's like, I don't really know, and maybe that's okay. You know, it was a good place to kind of take up residence, spiritually, religiously, and then realizing that it was okay, that the things that I believed started falling away from my mind, from my sense of belief, because there was no longer the requirement to believe them. It was like, within Mormonism, you have to believe a certain set of things in order to belong. And that's really kind of tested through temple recommend interviews and reinforced in a number of ways. But when there was no longer that requirement, particular requirements of belief to belong, I realized that many of the things that I had held on to try and achieve belonging, which hadn't really worked, I didn't actually have a strong resonance with those ideas. And in Mormon context, we would call that testimony, and building a testimony of different things. And I realized they didn't have to generate good feelings about ideas that weren't important to me, which, looking back, kind of feels like at least what some of that testimony building was about, like trying to generate good feelings about things that didn't really resonate, or some things that didn't resonate. And as I was able to realize, oh, wait, I can just let go. I can just let go of those things that don't resonate. And I ended up letting go of a lot of things, more than I had expected. And at the same time, Emily had suggested, well, why don't you try reading about maybe process theology? And that really helped me to change my conception of God from a God that like controls everything and is like the God, you know, a God of judgment who controls everything and maybe micromanages everything, to the idea of God as love and relationships, you know, and not necessarily as like a sky demon who zaps people when they do the wrong thing. And so, and I realize that, you know, like any and all of those concepts are fine. Like, you know, people can believe in the more traditional and that's fine, and in the less traditional and that's fine, and not really know and have tons of doubt and that's fine, you know, and so, like, it's, that's all fine. And what I came to realize is that one of the wonderful things about Community of Christ is that there was just a lot of space. And this is something that Robin had really emphasized from like the first time I had met with her, which is that, you know, there is enough space to figure things out in a fairly organic way within Community of Christ with regard to belief. And that the important thing for Community of Christ was a sense of shared values, with a specific list of like shared values. And, you know, I like that list of shared values. But I began to understand, I think, better that sense of shared values was more important to me than a sense of shared belief. And that really my Mormon feminist community that had been so important to me for years, you know, my online community that had been so important to me for years, was in part based on Mormonism, ended up being based on shared values. And so the more I saw those parallels of community based on shared values rather than particular requirements for belief, the more comfortable I felt, because it's like, okay, I can definitely do that. Like, that's good. Like, that's something I can, you know, I can go to a lot of different belief places, but I'm probably still going to have these values. And so wherever I go belief wise, you know, my sense of values probably isn't going to change all that much.
That is exactly how it felt for me. It's so interesting hearing you talk, because I really feel like I'm listening to myself talk. And my rationale for when we joined was exactly the same.
And that's such a freeing thing. Yeah. Like, that's like, not like, wow, you have to believe in these things in this way and feel good about this small, narrow set of beliefs, which you can neither prove nor disprove other than through feelings and spiritual experiences, which is fine. And that's a fine way to like, to live. But when you, if you grow out of that and you grow into a space of not believing and not belonging, that's just so painful. And so the idea that you would form a religious community based on values and not based on specific beliefs, like, that's like, what a breath of fresh air. And the more I understood that, and that we tried to live that through service and through different kinds of things that we did, you know, in our congregation, I realized that really did resonate with me. And that gave me the freedom to explore faith without consequences of my faith changing, without negative consequences, that I wouldn't suddenly find myself on the wrong side of belief, as I had in Mormonism, when I had that, you know, spiritual experience of feeling like God had told me that, had confirmed that women had been ordained and that they could be ordained. You know, I really, in that moment, found myself on the wrong side of belief. But that's not the way things happen in Community of Christ. And so it, coming to understand that, coming to shed belief and to realize that shedding belief was okay, like, that didn't bring me into conflict with anyone, that was really healing, and that I could even experience and express doubt in God. And I've always believed very strongly in God, and to realize that maybe God isn't offended by that, and that maybe that's just a healthy part of learning and growth, that was all just so important. And it's through kind of the summer and the end of the summer and the beginning of the school year, and through maybe changing my conception of God and embracing this idea of shared values and really in realizing the value of that kind of community system based on shared values and not on shared belief, that I just experienced a lot of healing, where I didn't really have to carry around that kind of pain of grief of having felt excluded from Mormonism, and then just finding community very easily in my new congregation, and And eventually we, with Emily, we kind of transformed from a more traditional church worship service to more of a discussion, sometimes with hymns and sort of worship service. And we ended up in our little congregation spending a lot of time talking about belief and doubt, a lot about doubt, without freely, you know, just freely and without worrying that we might express an idea that was going to, you know, offend people or cause us to suddenly not belong. And, you know, there are a lot of people in my congregation who really aren't sure what they believe. And that is no, like, impediment to them fully belonging and for them being a part of our congregation and or participating in any way. And that, I mean, I can't emphasize enough breath of fresh air that was, especially coming from a high demands religion like Mormonism and the LDS Church. And so in the last few months, I've been preparing for confirmation, just probably reading a few things that were suggested to me, trying to learn a little bit more about it and about Community of Christ. You know, like Emily is our pastor, but I also, she lives in Southern California, and so she's not here every week. And so, you know, one of my roles in our congregation is that I often, you know, help make sure things move along. I have the church keys and, you know, I do a lot of things to make sure that services happen on a Sunday when Emily isn't there. And, you know, and that's very much a shared effort, but there are ways that I get to lead routinely, even having not been a member and being a woman. And so those are all very different from my experience within Mormonism. And they've just been very affirming. They've been very affirming experiences. And so there's just been the space to let faith at first transform through kind of getting rid of doing a lot of purging and of things that no longer resonated, but then of growing a faith that focused more on community and relationships, and that helped to bring some of the activism in my life more in line. Like now I can see that the religion I participate in believes in, you know, social justice values. And I was, you know, did things this year, like be involved in helping to organize and carry out the first, St. George Pride, and that my faith and, my religious practice now are no longer in conflict with things like that. And that's, and I've seen greater like alignment of the things in my life. It's like, wait, the values that I have had are valued in Community of Christ. And this is a really good fit for me, religion wise. And instead of always being in conflict with, or feeling like what I was doing and feeling like I was doing, you know, good things or the right thing, but left me in conflict with my congregation, I don't have to worry about those kinds of tensions anymore. And those sorts of tensions were really eating up a lot of like mental energy that was difficult. And I don't have to deal with that particular difficulty. Rather, I can focus on, you know, issues of service and issues of social justice and see that all of that is aligned quite well with religious belief and community and practice. And I don't know, it's made me feel more whole as a person instead of being fragmented or pulled in many different directions.
Yeah, I identify with that a lot. I think that part of the transition for me, and I know a lot of other seekers, has been the ability to be ourselves. And mm-hmm. in that faith movement that we are allowed to be ourselves, that's when we discover who we are. And it almost feels like coming yeah. home. And I always described it as, I mean, I had older siblings, and friends and things that went on missions, and you hear these LDS missions and you hear these stories mm-hmm. of, you know, their converts and how they just felt like they were coming home and everything like that. And for me, that's how Community of Christ was, because like you said, those, mm-hmm. those different fragments of you, those different parts of who you mm-hmm. are could suddenly all come together, in the doubt and in the muckiness and in the uncertainty, and I didn't have to hide them or pretend that they were all nicely put together in like a Mormon package, that I could say, nope, mm-hmm. I've got this, you know, quote unquote flaw in my faith or whatever. And you could embrace it and realize that other people have that too. So mm-hmm. yeah, it was absolutely really liberating.
And I had also felt like as a Mormon that I think some of one of my vices within Mormonism, and I'm not saying this is true of everyone, but it is true of me and the kind of personality that I have, is I almost wanted to live out my religion competitively. And, mm-hmm. And I saw, you know, and there were certainly other people in my congregation taking up that challenge, right? Of like, who can be the Mormoniest or the faithfulest and the sense of like religion is like a checkbox competition. And because so many things can be reduced to checkboxes and there are a lot of long Mormon checkboxes, I really felt kind of embedded in competitive religion. And it's not that there wasn't a spiritual side to that as well, but that sense of like needing to be seen to be good enough and seeking for validation from a community that was never really going to be able to validate me. That was a difficult thing. And because those same structures don't exist within community of Christ, you know, I have really had to learn, and it's been a great kind of spiritual practice of being like, you know what, you know, like faith isn't a race, competitive religion isn't a thing. And like this is an individual journey thing, and then learning to respect both my own journey and struggle with faith, and at the same time the struggles of others. I just really feel like getting out of an environment where people were practicing faith competitively was a really healthy thing. I don't know if you would have said described your Mormon experience in that way.
Yeah, I think to some degree, I've always dealt with a lot of self-doubt and, mm-hmm. The idea that I didn't really have anything to offer. And mm-hmm. since I've been married, for the most part, I had callings just in primary serving with the children. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to say just,
yeah.
But that was consistently where I was put, either that or nursery. Mm-hmm. I had different callings when I was in like a singles ward, but I definitely felt that competitiveness, but I never felt like I could participate in that. So it's kind of interesting when I started to be in more of a leadership role in Salt Lake. I really struggled with it because it was mm-hmm. I almost felt like I was giving in to the competitiveness of religion that I had once known.
Right.
And it was hard for me to kind of accept that, you know, people did see me as a leader because I was afraid that we were playing into the competitiveness. So there was like this weird culture clash that was happening. Mm-hmm. I think realizing that, you know, we were able to go to World Conference and, mm-hmm. we went to, they had a mass caucus meeting for all of the Aaronic priesthood. And that was life-changing for me because I saw – I mean, we were some of the youngest people there. I mean, I'm 28.
Wow.
And, we saw 60-year-old deacons and teachers, and they were super happy with their office. And to me, seeing the church as – like kind of on a larger scale that way just really drove home – how not competitive Community of Christ is. And I mean, I know that there obviously are going to be people right. that feed into that. But the culture is very different. And I've realized how much of that baggage that I've brought into Community of Christ, like into my experience with Community of Christ, without even realizing that it was baggage, if that makes any sense to you at all.
No, totally. No. And I still feel like I'm going to spend – I feel like I've dealt with grief, a lot of grief, and really worked through that grief this year. But I still think that I'm going to be unpacking baggage for a long time, you know, because I just bring I just acquired so much.
Yeah.
baggage. And that's that. I feel like I'm always kind of encountering new baggage that's like crap. You know, like I gotta deal with this, you know, and, but I also feel like that's good and healthy, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, dealing with our baggage is good and healthy. And so, and that brings like personal growth and spiritual growth. And I feel like I can do that work safely, within Community of Christ. And so my attachment to Community of Christ has to do with good experiences and positive spiritual growth and even learning to be uncomfortable, you know, in the spaces of doubt and being uncertain. And that's all been like really good for me. And it's not that, every person I've encountered with Community of Christ is like this, you know, perfect person or anything. But I feel like through these spaces and through some great people to kind of mentor or guide or pastor, you know, I've been able to get to a much healthier, happier place with God and in faith. And that's been a tremendous blessing in my life. And I don't really know what faith for me will look like in the future. You know, I don't know. Or if I will, you know, can just kind of muddle along like most people, but it has been a year of healing this time that I've had with my congregation. So it's been really helpful.
Yeah. So, what do you see the potential, I guess, for Seeker Ministry or specifically for your congregation in St. George? Because I know a lot of times, I've heard seekers, you know, they'll show up at a congregation and they're used to an LDS ward that maybe has 300 mm-hmm. people in it. And then they go and there's maybe 10 or 15 if they're lucky or whatever. Yeah, right. And it can be kind of a moment of pausing to say, okay, do I want to rip my family out of, you know, this big mm-hmm. community to then plop them into, you know, a small community or whatever. There can be a lot of hesitancy, I guess. And so I'm interested because with you, you were among the first to even say, hey, can we get somebody down here? Because we have a group of people that are interested.
Yeah.
And so I guess, yeah. What are your thoughts on that? And I guess, I mean, I don't want to say bravery, but I think it's brave. I mean, the bravery to kind of step out and say, no, let's get this started. Or, I mean, if you were entering a new congregation or, you know, a new to you congregation, that might be smaller, I guess. What are mm-hmm. your thoughts on that?
So I would say with regard to like, my role in helping to found the Southern Utah congregation. I mean, I wouldn't say that it felt like bravery. It felt a little bit, a lot like inspiration and a lot like foolishness. Like, what am I doing? You know, like this, like, I feel like, you know, as a Mormon woman, like not only leaving or making a plan to leave Mormonism to go to another church, but to actually create one, right? Like that's, yeah. like that's, I'm not sure you can do anything worse. I mean, it, right? Like that's a whole other level of subversive, you yeah. know? And so there is nothing about that experience that the time looked like courage. You know, that looked a lot like and felt a lot like running away and feeling desperate that I needed something. You know, like that's I would say that. There was a lot of like feelings of desperation, of rejection, and knowing that I needed something, and you know maybe this new thing could be in many ways without actually knowing a great deal about Community of Christ, but having had people who I know and trust and love have had very positive experiences with Community of Christ, and then trying to like, you know, at least in reaching out to Robin, like trust in my friend's good experiences. For whatever that's worth. So there's nothing about that felt in any way like courage. It felt a lot like foolishness and potentially apostasy. So that did not feel good in that moment, but it felt like the right thing anyway. Sometimes God is like that. And it's kind of tricky. But and when we had our first service and we had like, I think there might've been 15 people at our first service, a little, you know, part of me was just super disappointed, not because I thought that there was anything wrong with the 15. It was actually more than I expected. But because I had grown up to associate lots of people in a meeting on a Sunday with truthfulness or with rightness, or, you know, there's that Mormonism is a good church to belong to because lots of people believe that it is a good church to belong to, many, many millions of people. And so to encounter like a Sunday meeting that was very small and intimate, felt a little bit wrong first. And then I realized that I was using the wrong metrics to like judge the experience. So there was a lot of like changing of expectation. And to realize that, and quickly see that the kind of tone and pace and interaction that happened, in those early meetings was just very different from what I had experienced. You know, there was the lighting of the candle and it's like, whoa, what are we doing here? Right. I mean, and if you've grown up in a very Mormon household, or which is in many ways, fairly anti-Catholic in its, rejection of being overly religious or using things like candles in a service, then some things can be initially a little jarring. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Like I remember coming home like one of the first times and my husband asking what we did, and I was like, they lit a candle. He's like, what? What are you doing? So there are some of these cultural, and we want to realize, right?
It's so funny because I totally remember thinking those exact same things. And now, like, I've been in right. Community of Christ long enough to, like,
right.
think it's normal, but it really wasn't at first.
Right.
Oh, man.
And like there was a chime. It's like, yeah. What is this? And not that it was bad. It was just so foreign to my church experience.
Exactly.
That it felt like, what are we doing? And realizing in those early moments, it's like, you know what? God isn't the candle and God isn't the chime and God isn't maybe the things that are making me feel a little bit culturally uncomfortable in the service, but maybe there's just good stuff here. And maybe it really isn't about the candle or about the chime, right? Like it's about other things. And so I think that there were just some initial like uncomfortableness with the service and the way the service was structured. There were also a lot of like set readings, like, you know, someone would get up and like read the prayer for peace or do like the response, like a response reading. And of course you don't do those things like in Mormonism. And so it's like, what are we doing here? You know, like, I mean, not what are we doing here, but like, why are we doing this in this way? And then over time coming to realize, you know what, when someone has really crafted some beautiful words and then to have someone read them, maybe that adds. Maybe it's okay to have scripts for the things that we might say and do in church sometimes. And it's not the same set script every time, but we can have, you can use those set scripts or think about them in the way that you think about like inspired writing and scripture, and that they can add meaning and experience, and poetry to the service without taking away from it because there are these scripted elements. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And I think that, so after we left, I've only been back to an LDS ward once, and I was, how do I want to say this? I was struck by the lack of chime and by the lack of candle. I mean, I obviously knew what to expect. I was still shocked, I guess, because I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, what you're used to is what you're used to. Mm-hmm. And it, your religious experience and your worship experience can quickly become, so ingrained in you. And I mean, I now right. know people who right. have, who are Mormon, who have personal ritual that they do, and they'll walk a labyrinth mm-hmm. or they'll light a candle. That was never part mm-hmm. of my Mormon experience. But yeah, I think that it's silly to think that, you know, maybe God only works in one type of worship service, and then to recognize that that's just our comfort level. Because I know, I mean, I know Community of Christ people that have gone to LDS services and they're like, what just happened? Like, Can we talk about what happened there? Like, why and yeah. how and who and, you know?
Yeah.
So.
And there's so much of that religious experience which becomes, like, the culture of the congregation or the culture of the denomination. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, and when you've mostly only experienced, you know, like, one way of doing things, then all other things, however minor, feel very significant in that moment. Before you're able to kind of look beyond what you're doing to the why and to what is, what are the messages. And so there was definitely some of that. But what I realized very quickly was that within a very small and intimate group, and sometimes it's just like me and a couple of people. And sometimes, you know, we've had maybe 20, you know, it's, you know, there's a lot of variation in kind of, in numbers on a Sunday, because many of the people in our congregation don't necessarily see themselves as an every Sunday family or an every, you know, an every Sunday kind of participant. And we accept that. Like, that is A-okay. Like, mm-hmm. There's no problem there. And there's certainly no requirement for belonging to our community and participating in a particularly consistent kind of way. Like, so that's, you know, all those expectations have to kind of go out the window. And that idea of pressuring people to do and participate in a way that makes them feel uncomfortable, all that has to kind of go out the window, because that's not what we're trying to achieve. We are trying to achieve, like, you know, authenticity and that feeling of people being able to kind of share their beliefs and share their doubts and share their problems or worries and concerns. In a way that is very authentic. And so, like, our services at the moment look a lot like discussion and donuts and hymns. And that looks very different. You know, we sit around kind of a table at the moment, and sometimes we use, the sanctuary of the church, but often we use a more informal space. And sometimes we even during the service do a service project. And so, belonging to Community of Christ has really shown me that, you know, there are a lot of ways to do church, and church doesn't have to look like sitting in a pew and listening and singing. And it can, and that can be a good way of doing church, but that there can be a lot of different ways that we do church and a lot of different ways that we acknowledge and worship God and then grow as a community. And that, church doesn't have to be one kind of experience. We had, a couple of months ago, Emily's husband, Daniel, plays the guitar really well and, came and did our worship with a guitar. And of course, if you've ever been Mormon, that's like never okay.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's, and I could feel once again, those uncomfortable feelings of engaging in, church music, which was maybe a little more contemporary, or the songs were based maybe like on African songs, like, you know, with rhythms that were different, and feeling that tension and then trying to recognize, no, that tension is a cultural tension. And because it's a cultural tension and not some kind of God tension or theology tension or whatever, that, like, I just need to realize that that's part of my baggage, and part of my baggage is, you know, expectations of how a church service should proceed. And even though I'm trying to change those very actively, there's still certainly moments when others challenge those expectations for me. And I just have to realize that, you know, God is not in the particular method of worship, but he is there, and he is there in our community. And it's good to be uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. I remember one time, and I don't know if I've mentioned this on the podcast, but in Salt Lake before the worship service, those who are participating will gather in prayer, and we usually will stand in a circle, hold hands, and pray together. And the first time, I was not a member at this point, but I was participating somehow in the service, and we did that, and it was – I guess it was kind of a trigger for me, because I'd never stood in a prayer circle outside of a Mormon temple. I think mm-hmm. I've since connected. I danced in high school, and we did some sort of like cheer prayer thing. But that was the closest that it was, and it freaked me out. I mean, and I'm trying to be respectful with that, but it it was one of those moments of uncomfortable cultural clashes. And I had to realize, like, okay, this discomfort is not because, like, this is a weird moment or community of Christ is weird for doing this. Like, this is my baggage that I'm bringing into this moment. And so how do I figure out how to shed that baggage and just enjoy a prayer? Because all this is a prayer, you know?
Right. And I think that there's a lot in there about respecting difference and the way in which different people connect with different modes of worship. Mm-hmm. Like one thing that happens in our congregation is that when prayers are said, they're often said very differently depending on who is saying them. You know, there are prayers to, you know, God the Father, and there are prayers to heavenly parents, and there are prayers to God. We have an atheist who is kind of our unofficial music director right now. So, and then there might be just good wishes sometimes, you know, and so, and all of that, is acceptable. And I think learning to realize that, you know, different elements of worship and the way we worship are really there to touch people differently. So like a song that's maybe done in a style that I'm not used to associating with church music might make me feel uncomfortable culturally, but then also make me realize that like, this has nothing to do with God. This has everything to do with me and my cultural expectations and me and the way, even it, me and white Christianity, right? Like, so, so maybe sometimes I just need to suck that up. Right. And like deal. And, but somebody else might experience that same music and be like, you know what, that was so touching. And that was, you know, I really felt the power of God through that song or through the energy of that song. And to just appreciate that my experience of feeling uncomfortable with my white Christianity and like somebody else's good feelings of feeling God through like really energetic music, that those are all good experiences to be having. And so, so when I'm just trying to take my uncomfortableness as a sign of, you know, like that's really not a bad thing for me to be experiencing. You know, it's maybe that is a learning moment or a moment when I can think about why I feel like church has to happen in a particular kind of way and what are the origins of those ideas. And it's never good. So like that's those are good things to kind of consider as well when we enter new kinds of religious spaces.
Yeah, I think that's really great advice for people stepping in to a new church for the first time. It's really good. Mm-hmm. So I guess what would your final thoughts be in terms of your hopes for the St. George congregation or congregations that are experiencing traffic from Latter-day Seekers? Or I guess what would your hopes or advice be for Latter-day Seekers themselves or struggling Mormons who are looking for a way to just make faith work in general?
So I think one of the first things that I wish that I had been telling myself or that someone else had been telling me very directly like a year ago would be like, there are no quick and easy fixes, right? You know, and part of me just wanted to jump wholeheartedly from like my ward to my new community of Christ congregation. And in some ways I did that, but also to let the development of and transitions happen. It's okay for them to happen slowly, right? If that makes sense.
Yeah, like, it does.
Right. And to realize and recognize the different transitions that are happening and that that's okay. And it's okay to see faith change, especially as you move away from places of certainty, that all kinds of crazy things can happen. And so suddenly if you find you wake up one morning and you realize like you no longer believe in the resurrection, like everything's going to be okay. You know, like it's like, it's going to be okay. And, that is a messy process. And that just like people grow and develop over time, that that faith growth and develop over time is a lifelong journey. And I think for people kind of dealing with Latter-day Seekers is to realize that, that they come from a religion that is very demanding. And that because the LDS Church and Mormonism is so demanding, like that's a long process, you know, and unpacking that is a long process. Transitioning to a healthy place can be a long process if someone is not in a healthy place. And that requires a lot of patience. You know, when I was kind of going through a very difficult part of my faith transition, I reached out to a friend of mine who I had worked on Ordained Women with, Christy Clegg, and she's a therapist. And I was just like, you know, we are really struggling. And she was like, you know, you just need to take this really slowly. And she'd been through her own faith transition. And she was like, you know, like, the slower you take this, the more grace and patience you have with yourself and you have with your husband, you know, the easier this is going to be. And she indicated that there were a number of times she wished she had given her husband and herself more patience and more time to kind of work through things at an organic pace. And so I think that is really important, that faith transitions are really big life events, right? They feel very internal, and they may impact like where we go on a Sunday and how we think about things and even some of the things we do and don't do in our lives. But they are really big. They are really big life-changing events. And because they are big life-changing events, you don't do like hurry through them, right? You need to kind of like, it's okay to kind of take that slowly and to try and learn as much as you can from that experience. It's okay to experience pain and grief, and it's okay to experience joy and feelings of liberation. And it's okay if you're feeling all of that like in one day. And to realize that the things you're feeling, you probably won't feel forever, and that the pain of a faith transition can and does diminish, and that you can transition to a place of happiness, and that really just takes time. And I think one of the fears that a lot of people express in leaving Mormonism is the fear that they will never be happy again, or that they could only ever be happy through the LDS Church. And that's something that's in some ways a part of like the conversations within Mormonism, but that's not true, and that people can, you know, it is a process and these things take time, but it does get better. And that you can find new meaningful things. For me in my faith journey, I've been able to find those good and meaningful things, and places of growth, within the community of Christ. And that's been very healthy and good for me. But to be patient with ourselves and with others. And what I see a lot on message boards and things and support groups for people in faith transitions is people feeling like a transition should really happen very quickly, and that when certain kinds of belief feel like they are no longer logical or rational, you should just abandon them very quickly. And I think that, you know, there's already a lot of pain inherent in a faith transition, and it's okay to act slowly. And one thing I've given myself permission this year is to act slowly. You know, part of me really wanted to be confirmed, 6 months ago, and realizing that there is a lot of wisdom in slow choices and in making careful choices, and making choices without feeling pressured, and in not just jumping from one thing to another thing, but taking time to think through choices, and that if we want to kind of recommit to God in some way, then God is okay with us like taking time with those choices. And so I feel like that's in part what I learned this year, which I had not realized before, that God is patient, and that I need to be patient too.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, when you think about it, we all come from faith, a foundation of faith that has likely taken more than 6 months to build. You know, and so, yeah, it makes a lot of sense that this period of transition and this deconstruction and then reconstruction would be an intentional process.
Yeah. So when I think that when we can understand what we're experiencing and why we're experiencing it, even though that's very uncomfortable, that there is a value to experience that, like that experiencing of the discomfort, that experiencing of doubt, that experiencing of a lack of certainty, and clearly understanding that our beliefs are shifting and that our priorities are maybe changing, you know, that's all like the good hard work of growing. And often we don't want to feel that because we just want to get to the good place. But I don't think we can really, you can't, there's no like shortcut to the end of a faith transition, right? Mm-hmm. There's no like, you don't get to like ride the slide to like the end, you know, by rolling a special number or something. You just, you have to experience, you know, this is an experience that you have to experience when you're going through it. And there's no like, there's no way to like shortcut that learning and growth. And that's, I think realizing that, or getting to a point where I realized that was helpful and healthy, because I wanted earlier this year, I wanted to shortchange that by just becoming confirmed and just like switching my identity from like one thing to the other thing without actually doing the work of letting identity shift in a more organic way. And I'm glad I did that work. You know, I'm glad I took time. I've been very committed to my congregation. This isn't really about commitment to congregation, but really letting identities shift and change and letting that happen kind of at its own pace.
There's a lot of wisdom in that. A lot. Thank you, Nancy. This has been really good. And I think that you've said a lot of very insightful things that have connected some dots for me and that I hope connects dots for other seekers. And I think our Community of Christ listeners will really appreciate what you've had to say too. I think that anytime that we can be honest about our faith and what works and what is helping us move forward is very helpful to the conversation. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
The views expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official views of the Latter-day Seekers team or of Community of Christ. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com.